Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
Also Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
Listen.
Happy September!
The burr months are upon us.
Burr. It's cold in here.
I mean, that's not what I meant, but accurate. Very accurate. For some reason, we live in the Northeast, and it's been like, it was hot, it was sweaty, it was violently warm outside, and then all of a sudden, a switch flipped, and it's like, it's cool. And like, it's getting to be like down to 40 at night. And I'm like so here for it, actually, because I've
always been there for it.
This is my favorite time of year. I was screaming at my daughter on the way home from camp this morning, pointing at all the leaves that are like just barely starting to change. I'm like, look, 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 fall, fall, fall. And it was a lot.
So this afternoon, I mean, many of you probably heard months ago, we had taken our families to Florida in the spring.
We did.
And I might have splurged when I was standing in front of the Hocus Pocus Lego set, Legoland. And I swore to myself I was not going to start it until fall. And
it's fall now.
And I said, I'm not going to do it. I want to, but I'm not going to do it. And I'm going to save it for a fall decoration.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm that tacky that I use Legos as decoration. Why the fuck not?
Bitch, don't.
You should see my bay window. It's all fake flowers.
It's okay. You're on the big 999. This is a reminder for Patreons also. If you haven't. Okay, first of all, we've gotten a lot of comments lately on the Patreon thing. I just want to point out that we know that the correct term is patrons. We know that. The term
you knew
patron,
that.
You guys knew that. No, I knew that.
Yeah,
and you know that. Shut up. You knew it too. Shut up. Shut your face. She knew it too, and I knew it.
Sure.
The correct term is patron. We say Patreons because
it's a thing.
It's just a thing. Okay, guys? We know that. Just
we are
to point
smart,
that out.
Educated women.
We are.
But thank you, internet.
Thank you for correcting us. We're going to keep calling it Patreon.
Because it's a thing.
That's a thing. Okay. Also, we have two newbies. Thank you, ladies. We have Hannah Miller.
Hannah Miller.
We also have Cynthia Voorhees.
Hey, hey.
Okay. You ladies
you
are
guys are
amazing.
Also so smart for getting in now.
Yeah.
Because you have an opportunity to vote.
Brilliant.
For your favorite Med Crimes podcast episode.
Yes.
To be part of our episode 100 top 10 extravaganza.
The votes are coming in. We will probably close that poll like sometime
within the next week.
Within the next week, so
yes.
That we have time to prepare our episode.
So if you're listening right now, it's Tuesday. Like, close it by the weekend.
Yep, I would say by Friday. Just log on there real quick, cast your vote. It's just that last post
because we are preparing.
We are, and we need to start getting our shit together on our end, guys.
I always have to get my shit together.
So much, so much shit. So, Hannah and Cynthia, welcome. Your creature is an animoi. Now, an animoi is a term used to refer to a group of Greek gods that are known as, like, the bringers of autumn.
Yeah, girls.
Yeah, girls. So,
yes.
You guys are the gods of wind, and you're the bringer of cool air and season changes, which I was like, that is so appropriate
done.
Right now.
Done, done, done.
I mean, if anybody does, it's you girls. If anybody is the animoi, it's you girls. So anyway, that's where we're at, baby.
My day is made.
Same, honestly. My day is also made. And you know what else is going to make my day?
Talking about this dude?
Yeah, like closing this shit out, okay?
Okay.
It's time to close
this
shit
out. Is it weird that
out.
It's been a couple weeks and my mind is blank?
No.
Like, I remember nothing.
You know what? It is really
isn't that weird?
Kind of a bummer that we can only do this every 2 weeks. And
God.
You know?
What a bummer.
What a bummer. I really wish we could bring things to you a little bit more often. Because that's part of the difficulty is that people kind of lose interest over 2 weeks, especially with these two-parters, right?
Right. Like, hey, who was that guy?
Who knows? Maybe that's going to change in the future. I don't know. Okay. Niels Hugel Pot de.
Was that your Easter egg?
No. Yeah. That was me being Taylor Swift, not so subtle. She at least has like some subtle intactness about it. Now, if you haven't heard part one, please go back and listen. Niels Hugel is a German nurse who was employed at two different German hospitals and was estimated to have killed somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 plus patients using a variety of medications and methods, and it's just really fucking awful what he did. And where we left off, he had been reassigned from the ICU, which is where he was working, to an anesthesia unit or a PACU type setting, and was soon thereafter let go from the Odenberg Clinic and is now working at the Delmenhorst Clinic, which is a hospital in a neighboring town, where he just kind of continues his shenanigans. So we're going to cover the rest of this and close this a-hole back out.
Closing the door.
Closing that door. Now, Hugel, I had been calling him Hogel, but it has been brought to my attention that it actually, with the two dots over the O, pardon me, I don't know exactly what that's called. It's a Hugel. Hugel. Like Google with an H is how it's actually pronounced. So thank you again, Internet. Now, after Hugel transferred to the Delmenhorst Clinic, he just like continued poisoning people, essentially, is what he was doing. What he really enjoyed doing was giving people different cardiac medications and potassium and calcium, things like that, of that nature, that would skew their hemodynamics in such a way that he would then have to go and try and resuscitate people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it worked and sometimes he ended up killing them. So he did a lot of damage that way. Now,
we don't like that.
No, he's really the worst, actually. And he, in the 2 years following his arrival at the Delmenhorst Clinic, he worked there full-time hours. The death rate in his ward doubled with his time there to an astonishing 73% of these deaths and bad outcomes matched his schedule to a T. So he was physically there in the unit or was recently in the unit for 73% of these events. So very clearly correlates there. Repeated emergencies seemed to just like follow wherever he went, but then inexplicably warnings and oddities went largely unaddressed by hospital management. And some of it was brought to management's attention and management kind of hush-hushed it.
Mm-hmm.
But also specifically at the Delmenhorst Clinic, there seemed to be this culture there that was, I mean, it's kind of all over Germany from what I'm gathering, but specifically to Delmenhorst, of you keep your head down, you do your job, and you don't ruffle any feathers. So it seems as though he was doing these things and maybe some of his colleagues that worked closely with him would notice that he was doing things inappropriately, wrongly, and chose not to say anything in a lot of situations. Yes.
I don't like that.
I don't either. We are used to the phrase, see something, say something, right? We hear that all the time. Sure. We've heard it all. And that is very much the culture in the U.S., but it's apparently, specifically at this clinic, there was this big, don't ruffle any feathers. You trust your colleagues implicitly. They're really, you don't question each other, because if you do, it makes the entire place look bad. And the entire profession.
Part of the where maybe you could have taken, like, it could have been taken as, like, you go in, you do your job, you don't ruffle feathers, and you get the fuck out of there as far as, like, drama. Mm-hmm. That would be nice.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, without some of the catty stuff that can happen in the healthcare stuff. But if you see somebody doing something wrong that's harming somebody.
Intentionally.
Yeah.
That's where I have a big problem with that whole scenario. Yeah. Because, like, to me, that at that moment, it's like, well, fuck the culture, kind of like you're just like murdering people over here. I don't care about the culture. Like, it's time to maybe not do that. I don't know. Just me. So he even earned the moniker Resuscitation Rambo. That was his nickname.
Mean, that's creative.
This was given to him from unit colleagues. Yeah, I know.
Da-da-da.
Well, that's Rocky, but still. Nice try, though.
That's so mean.
That is absolutely a Devin thing to do.
I tried.
I love you. Now, from his colleagues who had given him that moniker, Resuscitation Rambo, it was initially kind of like a joke, and how he like was always there and he was always jumping in and he was always like sort of shoving people out of the way to get to the front of the line when it was time to code somebody. And other staff even made him like a necklace at one point out of like old syringe parts for him to like wear, like as a joke.
Hilarious.
It is, but not so funny.
You don't joke on that shit if you're not supposed to ruffle any feathers.
That's right. Exactly. So, I mean, that's where this whole thing gets like kind of weird and tricky. Everybody kind of just
turns into that's just tacky.
It turns into
because some people
just
are
weird.
Laughing at it and may not have actually suspected him. It's all in good fun.
Yes.
And other people are like, I saw what you did.
Well, exactly. That's where it gets. And like, listen, I get it. Because when you work at a place for a long time and you work really hard, and sometimes there are situations where, you know, patient care can get dicey, things get exciting, things get scary, there's adrenaline. You develop a bond with your coworkers. You do. I have felt that before, like working in labor and delivery, working on the cardiology unit, because you go through shit together.
Yes.
You do. You code patients together. You do, like I did difficult births together, crazy C-sections together. And somehow that really brings you together as like a little work family. You know what I mean? So I get joking and laughing and decompressing, because even in situations where people are dying around you, sometimes like healthcare workers do have to joke and laugh a little bit.
Correct.
Because
or else we'll go nuts.
Otherwise, there's really not a very good way to cope. But also there's like a respectful and quiet way to do that, and a safe way to do that when it's not always appropriate. You know what I mean? Especially if deaths on your unit are suspiciously high.
Yes.
And you don't know what's going on.
Right.
And people are just dying around you, and you're maybe seeing some stuff that's making you question if people are doing it intentionally.
And
like
to jokingly state
don't
that it's
joke
this
about
person's
that.
Responsible.
That's not part of that little bonding experience. That's just weird.
Yep.
You know? So anyway, that's my 2 cents on that. Now, one situation arose in which a nurse who took over after Hugel on his assignment noticed that his patient's heart rate was jumping around pretty crazy. Like, Hugel had sort of left for the day. This other nurse kind of takes over that patient's care. And so the provider ended up ordering some lab work for this guy. And the patient's potassium level was sky high, like crazy high. All the other labs are looking normal. So it's like, there was really only a handful of reasons for that to happen, right? So medications can cause that. There are certain meds that can make your potassium go up. Renal failure, if you're not processing and filtering out that potassium, it can build up in your system. But neither of those things really applied to this patient. So there really was no reason that they could find for his potassium level to have gone from where it was the day prior, which was completely normal, to being wicked high, like crazy high. There's no reason that they found for this. So, of course, you can correct it with medications. This guy, they did end up correcting his potassium level and his heart rate went back to normal, thankfully.
Yeah, if you don't know the reason, then like preventative or, you know.
Well, that did raise red flags. And so the nurses ended up just like checking to see like, okay, so who took care of this guy before? Oh, it was Niels Hugel. Okay.
Oh, Rambo.
Rambo. So there were a couple nurses that kind of looked into things, looked at all of his documentation. Even the supervisor kind of looked at his documentation to see like, could there have been a med error or something? Of course, they couldn't find anything that would indicate that a med error was made, because he's being really secretive and sneaky about it. So nothing really came of that. But that's an example of the shit that would happen. And why it was so hard for anyone to be like, aha, because he was flying so far under the radar and he was playing with the lives of people that were already so vulnerable and kind of unstable. And like, it's not completely impossible that so-and-so's heart rate was going crazy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's just
sucks
that he got away with it for so long. Now, in June of 2005, the Delmenhorst police opened an inquiry because a staff member report stated that Hugel's suspicious behavior and the hospital records confirmed deaths doubling during his shifts. And this is how that whole thing went down. So there was like a tipping point. Police ended up being notified of his behavior because of there was a specific incident on June 22nd of 2000 at the Delmenhorst Clinic. Now, a colleague witnessed Hugel manipulating a patient's syringe pump deliberately, and she saw him injecting Ajmaline into this guy's lungs.
So she did say something.
She saw something. And
thank goodness.
You know, she saw him she physically laid eyes on him doing this. And there was nobody on the unit who had even had orders for Ajmaline. Like there was nobody who had even had plans to receive Ajmaline. So like this was not a grave error in which he was going for one patient and then went into the wrong patient's room. Like there was no question that he was doing this intentionally in that moment, and there was absolutely no reason
for
him to.
How did she know it was that med, I wonder?
Well, that's actually a great question. I'm not sure. But maybe she recognized the vial because she'd used it before.
Potentially, yeah.
You know what I mean? Recognized the bag, read the label.
I'm just curious as to what it was to be like, aha, that's Ajmaline.
Me too.
You know?
But she recognized it as Ajmaline, and she said, there's not even a patient on this floor receiving Ajmaline. So there's no way this was like an error, wrong patient. This was him going to find a medication that was not even ordered for a patient, walking into a random patient's room and giving it. And like, first of all, what business do you even have in this patient's room? It's not even your patient, this guy. That was enough for that nurse to finally bypass hospital administration and call the police directly. So thank God that happened, because that is what really started this whole thing to crumble.
Who knows what hospital administration would have done?
Oh, I know exactly what they would have done. And it was a whole lot of nothing.
Right.
They would have done absolutely nothing. And they would have just either terminated him or swept it under the rug and moved him to a different fucking unit.
Right.
And Ajmaline is that antiarrhythmic drug that we had talked about in part one that is mostly used for diagnostic purposes of certain cardiac arrhythmia ailments. In this scenario,
and one that we tend to not use.
Yeah, we tend to really not use it in the U.S. except for diagnostic purposes. I've actually never given it or used it myself. And I worked in cardiology for a long time. So it's just something that is not used very often here in the U.S., but it's used more often in Europe. But there was no reason for anybody to have it even at all on that unit. So that staff member then immediately took it upon themselves to notify police. So finally, she saw enough that she was like, I can't not do anything about this. Like, this was enough. This was not a whiff of something, a suspicion, or an inkling. This was, my eyes just saw this unfold, and I can't not do anything about it. Finally, saw something, and she said something.
Thank you.
So finally, a non-hospital entity were notified of the patterns established. And like I said, the deaths on this unit had doubled, and they had long established a pattern that Hogel was on the shift for 73% of these. So like, even hospital, like the unit administrators like knew that there was a pattern, and they were like investigating, but nothing was coming of this. So police were finally involved. And that same day, on June 22nd of 2005, he's arrested on the spot, ending his killing spree.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Now, a lot more information comes out upon his arrest, because...
Didn't you say in part one, like, he was, like, rolling the info off the tongue?
100%. Yeah, he never... There were some things that he took a while to admit, and he admitted some things, like, later on, like, 10 years later. But he was initially, like, pretty cooperative, actually, singing like a canary. So once he's arrested and interviews begin, he admits to intentionally administering cardiac medications to vulnerable ICU patients and floor patients. And once he starts talking, it becomes apparent to investigators that they have their work cut out for them, because this is massive. Like, all of a sudden, this is not one guy trying to kill somebody else in a hospital unit. This is a guy.
73% of all
this
of those
is
deaths. That,
years of him doing this almost every day.
Shit.
Almost every day. In fact, there was one weekend on record at Delmenhorst Clinic where he worked 2 12-hour shifts in a weekend, and 14 people died. 14 people had adverse events, unexpected medical deteriorations, and 5 of them died.
Wow.
And he admitted to being responsible for every single one of those events in a weekend. That is what we're talking about.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, he might have a shift here and there where he doesn't do anything, but then he shifts where he kills 7 to 10 people, you know?
Gosh.
And so that's the scale that police are like, oh my fuck.
I wonder how, like, he just determined, like, who.
It was incredibly random, what he said.
Not every patient that he had, but, like, how did he just decide, like, who?
A lot of it was, and he goes into it, but a lot of it is in the moment when he gets that urge and he gets that, like, little moment where, like, I have a minute, I have some downtime, I want to kill somebody, I need to kill somebody.
I have some downtime.
As one does.
Who should I kill today?
And he's which patient do I have the easiest access to, and which drugs do I have access to right now in this moment? And that's how he would determine it.
Insane.
Complete
chaos. Yeah,
complete
for sure.
And utter random, awful chaos. So he was suspected of many incidents, but as he starts giving more information, it becomes apparent that, like, we're talking hundreds over years, like hundreds of people. So now they're poring over medical records, building their own timelines, and now not on one hospital, but on 2 hospitals in 2 different units. This must have taken forever. You'll see when they finally try him for all of this, it has been over 10 years.
Because
this investigation, just gathering all of that, is
one event takes so long.
The manpower behind that is insane.
Wow.
So he starts disclosing some of the other medications he's used to toy with people's hemodynamics in many cases and kill them. We've discussed Ajmoline already, as well as potassium. He also used Sotalol. Sotalol is normally prescribed for ventricular arrhythmias. It's a beta blocker, strong, powerful beta blocker. A lot of people who start Sotalol, it's not something you can just like get an order from, like from your doctor and then like go pick it up at the pharmacy. You have to have like a Sotalol induction. You have to like stay in the hospital for like 3 to 5 days, have a heart monitor on while they put you on your loading dose. And then once they know that you tolerate it and your heart rhythm is going to stay stable on it, then they send you home. And this is a lot of times for treatment for like AFib that isn't responsive to, you know, regular beta blockers or calcium channel blockers.
It's heavy duty shit.
It's pretty heavy duty shit. We used to have to do that a lot on the cardiac floor, Sotalol initiations, and we used to have to hospitalize people for a few days. And it was all planned out. But he would give this, and it can, if it's given to somebody with like a normal like heart rate of like around 60 or 70, it will slow the heart rate or can cause lethal ventricular arrhythmias.
Wow.
So he would do that. He would also use lidocaine. Lidocaine is often used as like a code medication, or if somebody's in like VTAC per se or some kind of ventricular arrhythmia, you can give IV lidocaine and it will hopefully reverse that arrhythmia or it can stop it completely. But again, it can be fatal and induce bradycardia and a lot of other symptoms and tank your blood pressure if it's given to somebody with a normal heart rate. He also used amiodarone. It's another common one that we see and can be given in pill or IV form. But in his case, he would often give like a big IV bolus of it. Similar.
And again, and all of these are drugs that you would normally see on a cardiac unit. So like, and they're not things that are also, I would assume, like regularly monitored heavily.
No, they're not.
You know what I mean? Because,
exactly.
Like it's not like a controlled substance.
Exactly.
You know?
You mean you would think nothing of going into the Pyxis or Accudose or what have you and pulling out a dose of amiodarone on a cardiac floor. That's fucking every patient. You know what I mean? And like bags of it, like all of that is just stored, you know, not really under lock and key. All you got to do is swipe your badge and go in the room and get it. You know, why he was so dangerous is because he found this way to do this in such a, you know, innocuous way with all these medicines that were just like right at his fingertips all the time. Okay. It's crazy. Now, if you're given amiodarone with a normal heart rate, again, low blood pressure, low heart rate can make you die. Essentially, it fucks up the electrical conduction through the heart, just like a lot of these medications do. And then calcium chloride, another med used in CODES or critical care settings, an infusion can sharply alter heart conduction, especially if it's given in excess, which can cause arrhythmias and cardiac contractility failure. All of these things can have really catastrophic results if they're given to people with like normal hemodynamics. So with the effects of all these medications, the fallout from these were easily masked, again, as natural ICU complications, which is how he flew under the radar as well as he did. And even though the unit had concerns, even though he was present for an overwhelming number of events on all of his units, the fact is that these events were not implausible in those scenarios.
Right.
Right. So, and for authorities, making connections with physical evidence was challenging, right? Because first of all, a lot of time had passed between, you know, when he first started killing, allegedly, and now. I mean, it had been years, and there were hundreds of patients, many of whom had died and been buried. A lot of them had been cremated. Like, how are they going to get physical evidence to connect them to these?
Right.
They didn't have anything, really. It was all just, I mean, him confessing was great, but physical evidence is huge because he wasn't confessing to everything, like I said. So he was being cooperative, like, which is in giving some information, which is probably the only one good thing he ever did in his miserable life. And while he recalled some names and specific information about some of the patients he killed, there were some that he couldn't even remember because there were just so many and it was years ago. So he just killed them and didn't even bother to try and remember who they were and what their name was. Just a disposable, you know, source of, you know, humanity.
To get his urge out.
Exactly. So he went on to say that his motives were all self-inflation. He was very upfront about that. He was like, he would administer the drugs and attempt to save the patients immediately after, sometimes succeeding and sometimes not. And when asked if he ever got upset when he wasn't able to save the patients, he replied that it didn't really bother him. Although his colleagues that witnessed him on the unit would say, actually, like, he seemed pretty upset. Like, he seemed almost abnormally upset. But it seems like that was maybe an act to, again,
deter
and also get more sympathy, more attention, because that's what he wanted. And all of this was people looking at him and fawning over him. And
so they just wanted his to be, you know, obsessing over him, whether it was in a congratulations or I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
exactly. It didn't matter to him.
Exactly. So with these mountains of evidence needing to be gone through, He's initially charged with just a single murder because they're like, we would have to keep him in jail for so fucking long.
I mean,
like, there's no way. There's just so much. So they charge him with this one murder that he pleads guilty to. And Hugel's first sentenced on December of 2006 for attempted voluntary manslaughter in this single case, receiving 5 years in prison and a temporary employment ban. And this, at the very least, gets him incarcerated while authorities have a little bit of time.
So now they have 5 years. Exactly. Like, build a bigger case.
To build a little bit of a case. Exactly. So he did appeal. Upon his appeal in June 2008, the sentence is increased to 7.5 years and a lifelong employment ban. Whoops, shouldn't have done that. They were like, well, actually.
Why would he appeal if he pled guilty?
I don't really know, actually. That was weird. That was weird of him. And stupid, because he got more time after that. They looked at it again and were like, you know what? You
shouldn't have done that.
You're not getting out. And actually, you're not getting out for like another 2.5 years.
Yes.
So now Niels is safely in prison. Authorities are at work. They're able to establish all their timelines and pick out some deaths and medical events that happened during his time that were suspicious, and began pulling and building these massive lists of victims, basically. And in the following years, the list grows. And again, hundreds, literal hundreds of people. Now, there were so many, the experts really had to consider the possibility that this guy's full of shit.
Right.
That's also not implausible, right? Yep. Like, experts confirmed Hugel's competence in standing trial and verified that his confessions were likely not false. Like, they had psychologists, examine him, and they were like, no, this guy, wow, he knows some shit, and he likely did all of this. So that reinforced the credibility of the evidence, thankfully. Right. So they made sure this guy wasn't just blowing smoke up their asses for notoriety. So again, comes trying to directly connect them to their deaths with physical evidence. Because, you know, again, cardiac complications can happen. You know, it could very, like, we need to make sure that these people died because of exactly what he did. Because at the end of the day, they were all still in the ICU. Who knows? They didn't literally just have a heart attack and die. And it happened to be right after this guy gave them Exodol. You know what I mean? So some of the people that were identified had been cremated or were otherwise unavailable for any confirmatory toxicology testing. But in 2014, in a monumentous effort.
Monumentous!
More than 130 bodies were exhumed.
My God.
For forensic efforts to match toxicology samples to the cardiac drugs he used.
We've talked about
130.
We've talked about the loopholes that you have to go through to do one exhumation.
Yeah.
130.
130.
My God.
When I say monumentous, I mean, that is the man. Like I said, this took 10. This is in 2014. So this is almost 10 years after he's arrested. Wild. So out of the 130 bodies that were available for exhumation, toxicology testing was able to implicate Niels Hugel 97 additional murders officially.
Wow.
So involving this was involving both the Oldenburg and the Delmenhorst clinics.
Yeah.
So the charges were finally formalized 10 years later, and they were able to hold him without any bail pending that trial. So just in time for him to be able to get sprung after that 7.5 years, they're like, oh, here are the rest of those charges. You're not going anywhere now. We're holding you until your trial. No bail for you.
No.
No. The trial opens in October 2018, beginning with a moment of silence for the victims. Now, one of the biggest challenges for the prosecution was proving intent, because one of the big things that the defense had tried to do was say, you know what? He was trying to be helpful. He just thought that maybe this guy needed a little extra amiodarone in his life. He didn't mean to kill him. Like that, but that's bullshit. That's bullshit. And in many cases, Hugel had actually performed resuscitation events on his victims, which made it difficult to argue that he had intended for them to die.
Right.
Defense attorneys argued that Hugel had been a well-meaning nurse who had simply made mistakes or who had acted impulsively in moments of stress.
Lies.
Lies. But the prosecution pushed back, presenting a compelling case that Hugel's actions were not accidental, but deliberate. And they argued that this pattern of behavior, administering lethal doses of drugs and attempting to save his victims, was evidence of a twisted need for control and attention. And the toxicology reports from the exhumed bodies, combined with the testimony from his colleagues, painted a damning picture of a man who killed for thrill, basically. And
that needs to be the caption, the man who killed for thrill.
The man who killed for thrill. The main trial took place from October 2018 to May of 2019 in Oldenburg, Germany. And Hügel was charged with nearly 100 counts of murder during this time. And the Oldenburg and Delmenhorst clinics between February of 2000 and June of 2005. And out of those, he confessed on the very first day to 43 of them, but denied 5 and said he couldn't recall the other 52. Hence is why they ended up going to trial instead of, you know, him just, you know, being thrown in jail and pleading guilty.
Do you think he would really deny 5 if he didn't do those 5?
I mean, that's the thing. How could he even possibly remember? I think he was just probably trying to be difficult and make shit difficult for everybody else.
Yeah.
Just fucking admit to the other 5. You're already going to prison for life, dude.
Yes.
Bro, come on.
Yeah.
The atmosphere in the courtroom was very tense in the beginning. Journalists, families, survivors, all packed into the room, all eager to hear how the man who'd been called the most prolific serial killer in Germany's post-war history would respond to the charges against him. And Hügel was dressed in, like, this simple suit. He showed very little emotion. Like, there was nothing. Nothing. He was a stone face. If you look at photos of him, he looks like a foot. The man looks like a foot.
Big foot.
But this was like not the image of the crazed killer that people had like imagined. He looked, you know, he looked like detached, but he also looked like clean and, you know.
So a clean foot.
Clean. A very clean foot. Could totally have like a OnlyFans for that foot. Very clean. Now, he was just like watching the proceedings, sort of looking like he was just a spectator and like he wasn't like the central figure of all of this. He was just like very aloof, didn't really give a fuck about anything. That was sort of his demeanor through the entire trial. And actually, Judge Sebastian Berman, who presided over the trial, later remarked on how unnerving his demeanor was throughout the entire court proceedings. And he had stated, quote, "There was no emotion. It was as though he felt no connections to the lives he had taken. He showed no remorse, no guilt," end quote. And there were 32 witnesses involved. 8 testified under oath, including medical experts and colleagues. And in expert testimony, psychology concluded that Hügel's confessions were truthful. Again, even though he was capable of deceit, this was definitely all very truthful. The prosecution presented the timelines of his shifts on the unit, correlating with the patient's deaths, and all the forensic toxicology analytics of the 97 confirmed victims, as well as all those eyewitness accounts, and his subsequent aggressive resuscitation attempts that were all documented as suspicious behavior, leading to criminal scrutiny. And a former colleague testified that his colleagues had nicknamed him Resuscitation Rambo because he aggressively took over all those resuscitation efforts and highlighted his unusual behavior, which hinted at his modus operandi of using those emergencies to later, quote, save patients. Expert witnesses in the Niels Hügel trial explained that toxicology results from exhumed remains by detailing how high concentrations of specific cardiac medications like Ajmalin, Sotalol, Lidocaine, Amiodarone, calcium, how they were found in the victim's tissues, which couldn't really be explained by normal medical treatment. So like the levels of the drugs, like even if they were already on amiodarone pills every day, you know, would not explain the amount of amiodarone, for example, that was found in their system.
So they were able to testify that like the amount that they tested positive for was unreasonable.
Exactly. Yeah. Like that there's no other medical explanation for them to have that amount of Sotalol in their system. During the trial, relatives of victims spoke publicly about their grief and frustration over the prolonged trauma of unclear deaths. Mariah Richter, whose father had died under Hügel's care at Delmenhorst Hospital, attended every single day of the trial. And she had stated, quote, "It was like hearing my worst nightmare over and over and over again. The details were so cold, so calculated. I couldn't believe that someone could do something like this and then go on with their life as though nothing had happened," end quote. And Hans Meyer, whose wife had died under Hügel's care, took the stand to speak directly to the man who had robbed him of his partner of 40 years. His voice cracked with emotion as he recounted the final days of his wife's life, explaining how she had been recovering very well from her surgery before her sudden and unexplained death. He had stated, quote, "We thought she was going to come home. We had plans, a future, and then one day she was just gone. And now I know why. You took her from me. You stole our future," end quote. And as other families spoke, many turned to Hügel, hoping to see some sign of remorse or guilt, but he was just deadpan the entire time. Just even with people like pouring their hearts out and just, you know,
stoic. He's just
he was just nothing. There was just nothing. I mean, this guy is cold, completely detached.
Wow.
Just very eerie. Like that just sends a chill down my spine personally. Ingrid Fisher, whose mother had died under Hugel's care, expressed her frustration during the testimony and stated, quote, "We trusted you. You were supposed to care for her, to help her get better. Instead, you killed her. How could you do this? How could you look at her, look at us, and decide that her life didn't matter?" And that's the thing, too. Like, people's families were there visiting patients, probably meeting him, greeting him. And then, like, he leaves the room and comes back when they're gone and fucking poisons them with something. Like, that is just a monster. Monstrous. Exactly. Now, Judge Berman later described Hugel's confession as one of the most disturbing moments of the trial. He had stated, quote, "If it was as if he didn't see his patients as people. They were just objects, tools for him to use in his game of life and death. He confessed, but there was no emotion behind it. No sorrow, no regret." It's heavy. This trial, like just that magnitude and the volume of people must have been something so...
Witness statements always get me.
Yeah, they get me, like, too.
You know,
absolutely. The victim impact,
yes,
you know,
that's what I'm...
is crazy.
Yes.
And as a judge or as somebody who worked, you know, in the court or somebody who was listening in on this, like just unprecedented. You know, that volume is unprecedented. Now, Christian Marbach, who's a spokesperson for relatives, called the case a scandal and voiced that the demand for justice and closure, stating, quote, "We fought for 4 years for this trial and expect Hugel is sentenced for all of the murders." Now, on the last day of the trial, Hugel apologized directly to families, which, like, eye roll.
Lies.
You don't give a fuck. He states, quote, "I would like to sincerely apologize for everything I did to you over the course of years. I am really sorry." That's it, bro.
I bet he said it in a voice just like you said.
That's
that too.
See, that's that was I was trying. I was going for
mm-hmm. I
detached,
bet he said it in a
inhumane,
robot like
monstrous,
yeah.
robotic, because that's the vibe I get. Now, Judge Berman described his crimes as incomprehensible and expressed regret that the court could not lift the fog fully for many families due to the missing evidence from cremated bodies. You know, so like there's a lot of people that are just in limbo, like did right. he or didn't he? You uh-huh. know what I mean?
Right.
And he had stated, quote, "The fact is sometimes the worst fantasy is not enough to describe the truth," which that's profound.
Yeah.
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 He goes down in Germany's history as their most prolific post-war serial killer of all time. And in June 6, 2019, Oldenburg District Court Judge Berman stated at sentencing, quote, "Your guilt is unimaginable. Your human mind struggles to take in the sheer scale of these crimes." As he was, of course, convicted for all 97 counts.
Oh.
Yep. And the judge's ruling included a formal notation of, quote, "social severity." Now, usually this precludes any chance of early parole. So like he was sentenced to life in prison and he will never be released. But when the judge puts in a formal notation of special severity, that means this guy will never be considered for parole. He will never be considered for like work release. Wow. Like this was a effectively means Hugel should remain imprisoned permanently and never get a chance to interact with like regular people on any level, any capacity. And just as a side note, so Germany does not like so in the US, if somebody kills 97 people and they're convicted of every one, they could potentially get 97 consecutive life sentences.
Correct.
Right. We've heard
right,
that.
Yes.
Germany doesn't really do that. Like once they don't consecutive life sentences, which like I don't really realize, I guess, why we do that either. Other than like to make it look good on paper,
I think they're trying to make it known like each life counts. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
And
like,
I do get that. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right. So in that piece, that makes sense. So they don't really stack things together. So he receives one life sentence with special severity. That was his sentence. So he can just go fuck right off. And so the fallout following his arrest and the mega trial in 2018, several Delmenhorst staff are later charged with negligent manslaughter for failing to act on recognized warning signs and for failure to act on
That's
anything.
Right. You did say in part one that this would be one of the few times that we saw like administrative.
Yes, exactly.
Repercussions.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was a massive investigation into both clinics, really. Investigations concluded that leaders at Oldenburg and Delmenhorst provided references, enabling Hugel to move to new institutions rather than reporting the dangerous behavior. Because when he moved from Oldenburg to Delmenhorst, you know, they pushed him to move. They said, you can resign, you know, whatever. But they gave him a glowing recommendation. He was hired at Delmenhorst because
Correct.
They said he was conscientious.
Correct.
He was reliable.
Yeah.
they gave zero indication to Delmenhorst that he might have been fucking killing people.
Correct.
They gave zero indication. They gave him a good recommendation.
Just wanted to get him to move on.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So they were like under fire too for all of this. Specifically, it was six employees at Delmenhorst that were charged with negligent manslaughter after repeatedly ignoring warning signs and failing to intervene, even when a colleague directly witnessed Hugel injecting a patient with Ajmaline. So investigations at Oldenburg were ongoing as authorities criticized the transfer of Hugel, with positive references despite the awarenesses of all the anomalies and abnormalities in his conduct, effectively enabling him to continue all of his crimes. With the individuals in charges, the six Delmenhorst staff charged included nurses and a few members of hospital management. And because of German privacy laws, they actually never disclose the names of those people. But their negligence stemmed from not reporting or taking action, obviously, after he was, you know, clearly putting people at risk. And there were so many abnormalities that were reported. So both Delmenhorst and Oldenburg hospitals underwent widespread scrutiny. Staff were investigated, policies were reformed, reporting protocols were overhauled. So this changed
a lot. The culture was changed.
I'm hoping that means the culture was fucking changed.
Yeah.
Systemic flaws in hospital culture were then like highlighted, right? Because like, again, there's this culture of like, you always stick by your coworkers, you always back each other up, you keep your head down, you do your job, you go home, you don't fucking throw your coworkers under the bus for anything. Even if there's some like true concerns.
You need a clause in there.
You need a clause.
Unless they're a mass murderer.
Yeah. There needs to be like a little like subsection A,
Part B.
Exactly. There needs to be a thing in there. Now, Dr. Michael Hoffman, who's a physician who had worked with Hugel at Oldenburg Hospital, acknowledged during the trial that the culture of hierarchy in hospitals has often discouraged staff from questioning the actions of their colleagues. And there's always been this unwritten rule in hospitals. He had stated, quote, "You don't question your fellow professionals unless you have concrete evidence. But we've learned the hard way that silence can be deadly. We now have systems in place that encourage open communication and the reporting of any suspicious behavior."
Good.
Oh,
that's good.
And then perhaps one of the most significant changes that came in the wake of the Hugel case was the introduction of routine audits of patient deaths. So like in the past, hospitals had relied on, you know, internal reviews of death certificates to catch any anomalies. But this system obviously is inefficient because, you know, hospitals can just hide things internally. Yeah. So going forward, hospitals have implemented external audits to ensure that all patient deaths were thoroughly reviewed by independent bodies. So like third parties are looking at every death and auditing everything to see whether
common in the US, you think?
I think so. Not every death. God, right. No. If it is, I don't know about it. Maybe we do. Maybe we do that. I don't know about that. And it was just designed to like be able to track any patterns, catch any red flags.
Yep.
Or point to any like negligence. And then also like it wasn't always punitive. It was also like a way for them to improve their practices. Like if they catch any trends, you know, if there's something they can change.
QAPI.
Now, German patient safety standards and medical training curricula were updated to better recognize and act on suspicious deaths and staff behavior, including mandatory reporting channels and routine audits of drug stocks also. So now people are looking at the drug stocks and making sure it actually jives with what is being given on the unit. Thankfully. So, in summary, hospital staff at Delmenhorst were actually criminally charged for negligent manslaughter because of all of this. And while ongoing investigations at Oldenburg led to extensive institutional reforms aimed at preventing similar tragedies, basically. Dr. Petra Mueller, who's a senior administrator at Oldenburg Hospital, had spoken about the aftermath of the Hugel case and the struggle to restore trust from the community. And she had stated, quote, We lost something crucial. Patients and their families started to look at us differently, with suspicion and fear instead of trust. And it's hard to blame them. We failed them, and it will take years, maybe decades, to rebuild the confidence that was shattered. End quote. She's right. That makes sense that people are like, I don't really want to trust you with my medical care. How can I? And meanwhile, families of the deceased that are left grappling with their devastating losses, and nationwide reviews of hospital protocols occur to prevent future abuse. But these assholes always find a way to be assholes.
Correct.
You know, there's always going to be a way around it, in my opinion.
I think so, too.
They can do all the audits they want. Someone's still going to kill someone.
I still think, again, you know, it comes down to, as in many different circumstances with mass murderings and whatever, it comes down to mental health.
It really does.
There are things that we can put into place to help and to negate some of it and to try to prevent some of those things, but it's never going to solve all of it.
It's never going to make it go away.
Right.
Because people be people.
Yeah.
People are like some
Until
of the worst creatures.
The people. Yeah.
People are the worst creatures on the planet, and people be people. They're going to keep people in. That is the tale of Niels Hugel.
Thank you for listening, everybody. You can check us out on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast if you want to hear more.
Yep. You can also find us on YouTube by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
You can check us out on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you want to join our Patreon and get in on that vote for episode 100.
We're closing the poll out by the weekend.
That's right. You can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast.
You want to send us any crazy stories, suggestions, emails, be part of season 4's Break Room Banter that will be coming just around the corner.
Yeah, buddy.
You can send us emails at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Please stay safe out there.
Please. Stay tuned for big announcement on episode 100.
Yeah, buddy! Whoop, whoop. See something, say something.
Please. Bye.
We did it.
See something, say something.
Say something, say something.